these are what I would consider to be the primary instruments, the six primary instruments used for health measurement that we are currently exploring. And it's a nice way of just kind of having a look at them in one place. So I thought it might be a useful handout. If anyone wants my slides, they're welcome to them. Just shoot me an email later on. And I'm hoping it's somewhat interesting.
Yeah, we're also, you know, we have a website. So we're going to hopefully be able to post them there. And then
okay.
Keep the audio if we get our act together.
Okay.
Normally you don't need to just let's just briefly introduce you. Because you're our first outside speaker. Some of you have attended this before, but we're trying to do once a month this speaker series, and this is our honor to have a first outside speaker. The first two were internal, and next month is Bob Brook, so hopefully you'll be back for Bob Brook. And anyone who's interested in speaking in the series, please let me know, because we are going to need someone after Bob Brook, so we're really in need of additional speakers. So thank you, Benjamin, for coming.
Thank you. So I've known Amy for years, since we were both at AHRQ. We used to go to this pre-conference for Academy Health before it was Academy Health. My background is I'm an economist by trade. And this is a little bit about this new realm called comparative effectiveness research that we're all trying to figure out what it means. And I want to introduce you to kind of a bridging between some of the psychometrics and the econometrics as it may relate to comparative effectiveness research. Now, what do I mean by this? Well, what is comparative effectiveness research? Comparative effectiveness research is designed to inform healthcare decisions by providing evidence on the effectiveness, benefits, and harms of different treatment options. Now, I think that the definition is a little bit vague, a little bit unclear, but I'm going to try to give you my spin on what this might mean. Because, you know, where we are today, well, clinical trials have amassed a wealth of evidence on health outcomes, yet how to summarize and compare outcomes remains unclear. All right, and that is kind of a central issue that we're facing in comparative effectiveness research. How do you compare health outcomes? So how do we translate what we know about health outcomes into decision-relevant information? So let me break this down in rather simply. Imagine you had two treatments, treatment A and treatment B. And let's suppose treatment A had these following side effects. It had diarrhea, fatigue, depression, and loss of appetite. Okay. So that doesn't sound too good. So maybe you'll go to treatment B. Well, let's suppose treatment B had vomiting, rash, and pain, and maybe even dizziness. Which of these two treatments has a worse side effect profile? I mean, which treatment has worse adverse events? Now, this is commonplace, of course, in chemotherapeutic agents, where we look at their adverse events and we say, gosh, both of them look, you know, pretty strong, but which one, if they have similar efficacy, which one should be the dominant therapy? It's a hard question. We're not quite sure. So in this study, I'm going to introduce you to the concept of prudential algebra to help us handle this question and the measurement of health preferences. And then I'm going to go into a specific research project where I'm actually valuing the SF12 and the SF6D. Now, you have the instruments as reference material, so you can actually look at them if you're curious to see exactly what those instruments look like. And then I'm going to talk about where this might actually be useful. But let me first begin with an essay by our first comparative effectiveness researcher, okay, Benjamin Franklin. And why do I refer to him as a first comparative effectiveness researcher? Well, when writing to his friend Joseph Priestley, Franklin described the process of moral and prudential algebra to aid Joseph's decision on whether to accept a new position. Now, some of you from your training may have heard of Joseph Priestley. He's the one who discovered oxygen. I mean, we knew about it a little bit from application, but he's the one who actually discovered it. And Benjamin was teaching Joseph about the pro and con list. So what he said to Joseph is that, to get over this, my way is to divide half a sheet of paper by a line into two columns, writing over one pro and over other con. Then, during 3 or 4 days consideration, I put down under different heads short hints of the different motives that at different times occurred to me for and against the measure. When I have thus got them all together in one view, I endeavor to estimate their respective weights, and where I find two of equal weight, I strike them both out. If I find a reason pro equal to two reasons con, I strike out the three. If I judge two reasons equal to some three reasons pro, I strike out the five, and thus proceed at length where the balance lies. To identify at length where the balance lies. And if, after 2 or 3 days of further consideration, nothing new of importance occurs on either side, I come to a determination accordingly. So this is what Franklin actually recommended for handling personal dilemmas. And today we all know this as the pro and con list. And this is Franklin's rule. So Franklin also passes on to his grandnephew, who is trying to decide in whether to marry. So Franklin was telling his nephew, follow your own judgment, and if you doubt, set down all reasons pro and con and opposite sheets of paper, etc., etc. This kind of moral algebra I have often practiced in important and dubious concerns. Though it cannot be mathematically exact, I have found it extremely useful. By the way, if you do not learn it, I apprehend you will never be married. I am ever your affectionate uncle, Benjamin Franklin. Well, when Franklin came over to Europe at near the end of his life, he told this to a number of different philosophers, including Joseph Priestley, but also Jeremy Bentham, which was his junior at the time. Now, many of us know Jeremy Bentham as an advocate of utilitarianism and for his contribution to welfareism. But Benjamin Franklin was his direct or indirect source, direct or indirect, for this idea of classification by bipartition plus measurement of the relative weight of two classes. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, Bentham would take a list like Franklin's list, and he would quantify each item on both sides of the columns. After quantifying the items, he would sum them up and then look at the difference. The sums may inform the decision, okay? So you can think of what Bentham did beyond Franklin is just the quantification of those outcomes. Bentham actually took the phrase, the greatest good for the greatest number, from Joseph Priestley's essay on government, okay? Now today, of course, we know this from Dr. Spock, or Mr. Spock, but, that was the original source. So okay, what does this mean for decisions in healthcare? Well, when we think about healthcare decisions and the outcomes, we first need to decide what are the outcomes most important to us. And there are typically two. There's quantity of life. And quantity of life can be thought of in a number of ways. Number of persons affected, duration alive, or risk of death. That's how we simply measure the quantity of life. And then the second domain is quality of life. Okay? Quality of life, we can refer to that as patient-reported outcomes, such as a pain scale, or you might think of it as clinical outcomes, such as adverse events or unconsciousness. So when you think about what you might find on those two columns, you would think of attributes referring to quantity of life and attributes referring to quality of life. The value of these outcomes likely varies, and that's where it comes into, that's the difficult part. It's not difficult for a clinical trial to tell you about differences in the outcomes between the two treatments, but it's difficult to understand what the value is of each of those outcomes. What weights should you apply to those outcomes? Now, there are two ways of defining those weights, okay? And some of you may have heard this before in different contexts. The first way, and this is coming from the literature from the 1940s and 50s, the first way is called a trade-off response. The second way is called a discrete choice. Those are the two ways that we use to define weights. Now, what do I mean by a trade-off response? Well, trade-off responses equate losses in quality of life to losses in quantity of life. So how many of you have heard of the standard gamble? Okay, that's trading off a risk of mortality. How many of you have heard of time trade-off? Okay, well, that's trading off a length of life. So trading off a quantity of life, such as the time you're alive, for a quality of life, is kind of like changing this scale over here. Okay? Discrete choices do something very different. What we do in discrete choices is we compare losses in quality of life to other losses in quality of life. Is pain more important or less important than depression? Okay? So those are the two ways that we try to elicit or try to find out what people's values are. So imagine a health scenario of 10 years with moderate depression followed by death. A trade-off response or a trade-off question might be, how many years without depression is it worth? So I can move that little scale on the right to actually determine what the relative value of depression is, a moderate depression is. On the other hand, a choice, a discrete choice would be rephrasing the question and saying, is it worth more than or less than 10 years with moderate pain? Okay, here we would prefer 10 years with moderate depression over 10 years with moderate pain. No takers? Well, that's what we basically do in these surveys. And I'll actually pass around my survey instrument in case you're actually curious to see what it looks like. I'll go through it also on the screen. So, now, you might be asking, what does this have to do with economics? Where is the economics in this? I mean, you have an economist telling us about health outcomes. What did we know about this type of stuff? Well, I assume many of you have taken economics courses at one time in your career, in your lives, and so forth. Well, this is the law of demand, okay? Okay, on the y-axis here, you have price. On the x-axis, you have demand. So if prices are low, demand is high. You know, you don't have to, it's pretty well established that people don't like high prices. But what does this mean in terms of health outcomes? Well, I'm going to play a bit of a devil's advocate here, and I'm going to ask you what your demand is, or how much are you willing to suffer to avoid moderate depression? So I really want to hear your response, so please raise your hand. I'm going to ask you a series of three questions. Well, let me ask you the first question. How much are you willing to suffer to avoid moderate depression? Are you willing to suffer severe pain to avoid moderate depression? No? No takers?
Depends for how long.
Okay. Let's suppose it's 10 years. Severe pain for 10 years or moderate depression for 10 years. No takers on that one. Okay, I'm going to lower the price a little bit. Let's see how many of you buy into this market. I'm going to say, what about moderate pain for 10 years versus moderate depression for 10 years? Okay, we have one. Okay, so the demand's a little higher for that. I lower the price. Demand shifted out. Two, okay. Now let's suppose I lower the price even farther. And I ask, what about mild pain for 10 years versus moderate depression for 10 years? Okay, there we go. So you can see how this kind of trades off. Okay, in other words, by changing this, I understand your demand or your willingness to suffer or to avoid.
So are you asking these questions to people who have suffered this? Versus from a societal perspective where people have not suffered.
You're
going to go with that?
There are demand curves for each population. Demands reflect a market. So yes, you're right. demand for glasses may matter if you have an eyesight problem. Okay? There are different demands for different markets. And yes, it's important to know what the demand is for each market. So in a particular population, maybe depression is more important. In another population, depression is less important.
Well, it also, to some extent, is going to depend on what a person understands moderate depression to be like, or what they understand severe pain or moderate pain or mild pain to be like.
Yes. And then similarly, if you what you would think the iPads are like, or what you think your use might be, might decide on whether or not you go off and buy one for the price that they're currently shown. We focus largely on decisional utilities. Decisional utilities reflect what decisions people make. And that decision, in this case, means a survey question. But You could also make a translation to other environments. Not necessarily experience utilities, which is a different art discussion entirely. So how to estimate weights for A and B. So remember, these are the attributes for each of the treatments. We want to figure out the weights for A versus the four weights for on A and the four weights on B. Well, the first thing you need to do is you need to identify the decision-relevant outcomes, okay, and how to measure them. The next thing you want to do is construct a series of meaningful choices, basically asking them to compare something in A versus something in B, or even things within A, to understand the relative importance of each of these outcomes. Then you need to ask your target population. Now, whichever target population you have, you need to ask your target population to choose among them. Okay? And that is the process called evaluation survey, and that is really the topic of today. And then you estimate the weights, you sum the weights, and that's referred to part worth utilities, and hopefully that will help you guide your decision about which drug you should get. So what do I mean by this specifically? And I'm passing around the survey instrument so you have a clear understanding. And this is taken directly from that survey instrument. This is an online survey. A paired comparison is a choice between two alternatives. For example, which fruit do you prefer? Choose by clicking the circle under the preferred fruit. Now, I happen to be coming here from Florida, and I'm pleased to say that the orange is preferred 58 to 42%. Okay? So that just happens to be in this national survey. But it gives you an understanding of what the demand is. So these are the results out of 2,114 choices. The orange is preferred. And under a simple logit model, I could say that the part worth utility of an orange with respect to an apple is the log of the fraction of those two numbers, also referred to as 0.1 utils. Now, what is utils? It's an unscaled amount. But it reflects the decisional utility that was expressed among the sample. So next, we might take two separate pieces of fruit, put them up on the screen, and actually see what people's values are for different pieces of fruit. The shocking thing is, and I think maybe it's not shocking to this audience, is that, you know, soda manufacturers and you know, selling water, we've done more research on the relative value of drinks than we have on healthcare in terms of doing these types of experiments. And it'd be fascinating to me if we could get over and actually apply some of these techniques. I mean, I'm sure you've heard this before on how cigarette manufacturers spend a large amount of money on investigating which marketing campaigns best work for them. Yet, the anti-tobacco is just still coming around to those, to not even close to the amount of money. Take some years before they can accommodate that. So in our study, we compared decrements in health, not fruit. So this is what our study actually looks like. So look at the two changes in the original scenario and read the descriptions carefully. Imagine that you must live in the health scenario for 10 years and then die. Which scenario do you prefer? Choose by clicking the circle under the scenario you prefer. If you'd like to read the original description, of the original scenario again, click here, and then it pops open, and you can see it. It's shown on the slides there. So here's a question that you'd be asked in the survey. Your health limits your social activity most of the time versus your health limits your social activity all the time. Well, over here, your health limits you in kind of work or other regular daily activity as a result of your physical health. You are not limited in any kind of work or other regular activities. Okay, so this is the question that we're asking. We're asking them, all the time over there, that's not so good, but your health does not limit you in work or other regular daily activities. Which one would you prefer?
So these are linked, so it's the social plus work.
So over here, you have some problems with your physical health, but you're better off in terms of social activities. Over here, you're worse off in your social activities, but you're better off in your work. Okay? It's kind of like the pain depression one that we were talking about before. Basically, they're asked 24 of these questions. That's it. Yes?
And they always have to make a choice. Right?
They always have to make a choice. There's no opting out.
Because in standard Campbell and time trade-off, you are allowed to say no preference if you do face-to-face standard Campbell.
There are different protocols for that. There are a variety of techniques. The original MBH, no, you had to answer. You didn't get a chance to drop out. The original study that did the UK value set, you had to. But this is a simple way of collecting choice preferences.
You mean you can't say you have no preference?
You can't say you have no preference. You can randomly choose. The fascinating thing is we're actually collecting paradata on these people, and we can actually watch them go eeny, meeny, miny, moe. Okay, because we know each time they change their choice. And if you hold the tab key down, it'll just go back and forth really fast. But we collect each of the times it shifts. Okay, so we actually can look at some of those indecision or changing of response and how that relates to the estimate, see if whether or not that adds randomness.
What was in the original scenario? It just flushes out more what types of activities?
We used one original scenario that it was a fair scenario, and a second original scenario, a new scenario that was a good scenario, and we altered them by respondents. So sometimes they got the fair one first, sometimes they got the good, and they got the good one second, or sometimes they got the good one first and they got the fair one second. The question is, does the null, if your overall health is fair or your overall health is good, does that really change your preferences between these things? So that's one of the hypotheses we're going to be testing. Yes?
And what about the same for the initial condition? I mean, introverts versus extroverts seems to me is what the top says.
Well, that possibly could be, but that would be expressed in your value structure about social activities. Maybe you don't like social activities, and therefore, for you...
No, what I'm saying is you're setting preconditions about physical health, but the preconditions about people's social preferences for social interaction are, in general, somewhat hardwired.
That is a good point. Some people may not like social. That's a problem with also the vitality one. We have that difficulty, which is some people don't want to have lots of energy all the time. All right, but that's considered to be the most higher end there. And so, yeah, each of these domains, you assume that they're unidimensional, and more is better, but maybe not for some individuals. Okay, so what are we trying to value? Well, like I said, we have all these health outcomes that we're measuring, and we're trying to put weights on them. So I'm going to start off with two primary descriptive systems. A descriptive system, I mean, measures health decrements using clinical or patient report outcomes. A classic example, of course, is the Medical Outcome Survey 36-item short form, or the SF36 version 1. Now the attributes for our analysis, we just relabel them and label them as in one represents the best and the numbers greater than one are incrementally worse. Okay? So the optimal is all ones. So for the purpose of this study, we're going to estimate the weights of two patient-reported outcome descriptive systems, the SF60 and the SF12. And weights are what we remember as being the values on the columns. The weights need to be estimated for each decrement. And by what I mean by a decrement is you can imagine the pain at level 1 moving to level 2, some pain, and that would be one level of decrement. So we want to know how bad that is. Now weights are assumed to be non-negative, and I think that was your point. Well, how do you know that some people might like pain? You know, like, well, by the construction of the descriptive system, it's assumed that the scale is unidimensional with regards to health. Okay, it's not supposed to be U-shaped. So, the SF12 version 1, excluding the first question, which is general health, excellent, very good, good, fair, poor, has 11 items. So therefore, the best is 11 ones, and the worst comes out to be a vector like that. And so, as you can imagine, that across the 11 items, there are 31 possible decrements. So essentially, it's kind of like having a basket of fruit with 31 different types of fruit in it. I want to estimate the value of each piece of fruit in that basket. The SF6D, which was based off of a derivation off of the SF36 version 1, has only 6 items, so 6 ones versus that vector. And across those 6 items, there are 25 possible decrements. So in the end of the day, each of these studies, the first one is trying to estimate the 2031 decrements, the second one is trying to estimate the 25 decrements. But for your research, anything that can be measured can be valued. Anything that can be measured can be valued. I don't know what outcomes instruments you're using, but if you want to be able to translate those outcomes into something that's decisionally relevant, you might consider doing a valuation study. Okay? And I'll talk to you about a couple other projects that we're working on. These are just two. Why am I doing these two? How many of you guys have seen the other literature? At this time, this will be the first study to estimate QALYs, or quality-adjusted life years, for the SF-12 version 1, and for the SF-6D for the United States. And therefore, it will be very useful because there's a lot of SF-36 data sitting around. It'd be nice to be able to put that into decision-relevant units. So using paired comparison, each decrement is compared to multiple other decrements in order to collect decisional data, as in each fruit is compared to multiple other fruit.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
Since John Brazier did it in the UK, you're using a different method for listing preferences. You don't really care now to compare whether they're equivalent or not in the US and UK.
Well, that's a bit of a comp. John's on this paper too. So John made a couple errors in his first paper that he'll recognize, and I don't want to spend the time on necessarily, to really say that the values that he generated from his original study aren't necessarily the ones you might want to use. Not just because it's UK, but because they made a series of questions. I mean, he changed a quarter of his data to make his estimates look good. Okay, and since that has come to light, it's kind of been in like, oh gosh, should we be using these SF-6D values anymore from the original study? But they're useful, but they have some issues.
I guess it's more like the standard gamble he used.
Yeah. He used standard gamble, but he changed a large portion of the standard gamble data before the estimation.
Yeah. Well, I guess that means that it wouldn't be good to compare with that because it's garbage data, but why aren't you using standard gamble?
The reason that why we don't use, well, in some sense we are using standard gamble. See, a standard gamble is a series of paired comparisons, okay, which include a risk of death. And that's exactly what we also do here, is that we actually include a risk of death. The difference between a standard gamble and what we're doing, though, is kind of like the difference between an adaptive survey design and a randomized design. An adaptive survey design says, depending on your answer to question one, I'm going to give you a different question two. Or depending on your answer to question two, I'm going to give you a different question three. And that's what the standard gamble does. Because of that, all the error in your fourth question is dependent upon all your errors on the first three questions. Okay? And this is not something unique to evaluation studies. It's also in other forms of psychometrics. Yes?
So just looking through the surveys there, the examples that you provided, it seems like a number of them ask the participant to imagine themselves effectively a different person. And then, how would you respond if you had a choice between A and B as that different person? So is there any, taking a step back from that, how accurate is that initial impression? How good are people at actually, you know, we take people who were effectively without a disability beforehand, interview them beforehand, and then, you know, if enough of them actually have a disability later, say, how accurate was your impression of where that actually, what that disability was meant for you?
There are two points to that question. The first point is there are different markets out there. So interviewing patients versus interviewing, or people with experience versus people without experience, you'll find different demands. The second point to that, though, is that we do that. We actually ask people or have them value other people's health, namely children's health or unconscious people's health. You can't get a person who's unconscious to value their own health. So sometimes when you have dependents of that type, you must, in your evaluation, say, have them value some people other than themselves. So that gets into altruism, fairness, and some other things that we try to stay away from, which is why we have people value themselves.
But I guess what I'm getting is it seems like this is the gamble that's being provided is a relative change after a relative change from their current state of being. So you're asking for sort of a two-step process in their estimation of where they're going to be at some point in time,
yeah,
which could vary markedly in terms of their ability to conceptualize that, and they may be way off base if they actually would have experienced it at a later point and say, you know, I never would have done that and I didn't understand the real question.
Well, I'll lead into this, okay? And you could also strictly say this is all bunk because people could just be pulling out their answers as most randomly. But the example I would say, and this is what we actually use when we explain these surveys, is voting. You don't know what you're going to be next year after the election, but you're going to have to choose between the two candidates today. And wouldn't you want your government to listen to what your values are and therefore setting its priorities according to their value, to those values? Now, it's true, we're not asking you a year from now when we actually have the person in office. We're asking you to hypothetically consider which of these candidates would you like to have in there. It's a little different in that sense. There are other approaches, marketing approaches, that try to pay people to be more honest. They haven't worked out very well either. But aside from that, unfortunately, we can't randomize people to the actual experience. We're not putting, you're right, they don't have anything online in that sense. But this is a very simple survey. It's a pilot study. So we sent out over 100,000 email invitations. We got about 3,000 subjects to consent. 2,000 began the paired comparisons, and only about 1,600 actually finished them. Our biggest bottleneck here between these two, the biggest drop-ins, because we required the collection of pair data, some people did not have JavaScript activated on their computers. Okay, so we lost a lot of people because of that. The pairs were randomly assigned in sequence, top, bottom, left, right order. And compensation, well, they basically received about 200 points within the online panel survey system for reimbursement. And even if they didn't qualify for our survey, if they were kicked out due to software issues and so forth, they were allowed to participate in as an entry into a monthly cash sweepstakes. The survey that I distributed has basically the following components. First, it's just 8 demographic, SES, and geographic items, followed by the SF36, the Apple versus Orange, 24 paired comparisons. Then we gave them a practice question, including risks of death. And the reason why you need to do these last 6 pairs that look at decrements in the health with regards to risks of death is because you need those 6 pairs in order to make qualies. In other words, qualies are anchored on a scale where 0 represents death and 1 represents optimal health. Well, in order to put things onto that scale, you need to know the value of death. So we had to add one domain, which is your risk of death, in order to estimate qualities. That's very similar to the standard gamma. Then we had 15 items for follow-up. We collected paradata on every response timing, changing, browser type. One person did actually take our survey on the iPad. That was interesting. And the survey took from about 20 to 26 minutes. That's the interquartile range. From this, using these basically binary data, we estimated a random utility model, which implies a choice that the value is the log of choice over the probability of choice. And these values represent the relative difference in the intrinsic utility as described by the paired comparisons. The values are typically translated into qualities, but you know, I want to, all the debate that we're having right now, I mean, you can't do CER with cost right now. They've said they've nixed that. Now they're starting to say, we don't want you to use qualies. It's like, I'm not a big fan of qualies myself. Okay? What I do find interesting is that some things are more important to people than others. And understanding their preferences, or understanding which domains or items are more important to them, that's what we do need to have. Okay? If you don't want to boil it all down into common units, into qualies, okay, there are some theoretical assumptions of qualities that we might find a little bit distasteful. But it makes it a bit more useful to have it in a common metric. If you don't like qualities, that's fine. We'll probably change its name and use something else that's preference-based. So rescaling the estimated values into qualities was incorporated directly into the model using an auxiliary model and the responses of a series of pairs that include the risk of immediate death. You can see those in there. This is where I really want to spend a little bit of time. So, each of these represent a decrement in health. So this is from 1 to 2, or 2 to 3. So you can imagine moderate activities, no limitation to some limitation to a great deal of limitation here. And you can see that, okay, this item here, well, it was somewhat important. It only had 0.04 level of importance. In other words, the difference between a person with a 1 and a person with a 3, 0.04 qualities. Not so much. On the other hand, pain, a difference between a 1 and a 5 was almost 0.1 qualities. Okay, that's more important. If you look at this across the board, which of these items were more important to people? Well, you would say pain was very important. This decrement of having no energy all the time, this decrement, no energy all the time versus a little bit of energy is much more important than all the other decrements in energy combined. Okay, that's the one that people really found to be important. Also, similarly here, you find that the last decrements are more important to these individuals. So when you think about looking at these descriptive systems, while it might be nice to measure things among people in good health, when you ask people to do the valuation, it's the jumps at the ends of the scales. Those are the ones that people really find to be very important. You can see a very similar process. Oh, these are the ones that are relating to physical functioning and role limitation. It's kind of difficult because you probably want to stack these up. This is climbing stairs and moderate activities. You could say that physical functioning in terms of moderate activities and climbing stairs, when you put them on top of each other, they kind of beat out issues with energy. So in review, the largest decrements, calm and peaceful a little of the time versus none of the time, that was a big one. Okay, if you're not calm and peaceful, if you're calm and peaceful none of the time, that's pretty bad. That's a big decrement. But a lot of energy all the time versus a lot of energy most of the time, people looked at it and said, that's not important to me. That has zero value. Okay, so here's a hard question. If a decrement between these two on this item has no value to people, why are we collecting the data? Okay? If a decrement has no value to society, then why are we collecting those data? So it's different than the psychometric, which says, oh, we're able to understand better the full scale. But some of these parts of the scale don't matter. Some parts of the scale really matter. The low ends of the scale really matter. And maybe that's what we should be focusing on. So attribute importance, pain and depression, very important. Energy, not so important. Decrement size tends to increase with severity. Okay? Things at the top, things that are really bad, are more important. This is the SF60. So the SF60 has only 6 domains. And you can look here and say, aha, yes, pain's much more important. The scale is a bit different, okay, because this is 0.1. 0.1 was really high. So this one says that pain is very important. I mean, going from a 1 to a 6 in pain, according to the SF6D, okay, is a difference between a quality of, a difference of 0.6 quality, 0.16 qualities. That's pretty big, all right? So you might want to say, but when you talk about physical functioning, this is problems with self-care, bathing and dressing. That's what mattered to these people. They looked at that and said, gosh, that's bad. That's what I find really important. Okay? Vitality seemed to be a little bit less important. Role limitations, less important. So the largest decrements, okay, pain, very big. Going from pain interfered quite a bit to pain interfered extremely, 0.06. That one change, that one little jump, very important to people. On the other hand, once again, a lot of energy all the time to most of the time, not important. One that was kind of interesting, and this is a problem with his measure, with Brazier's measure, is that the shift from 4 to 5 on physical functioning, 4 being limited a lot in moderate activities, and limited a little in bathing and dressing, had no value. I think that's also because they weren't able to discern the difference between those two. I mean, which is it? Is a little bit of problems with bathing and dressing that much worse than having some problems with moderate activity?
It depends who you ask. If you ask the arthritis patient with rheumatoid arthritis, yes. and they would give it a much higher valuation than what the supposedly general population here.
Yeah, it could be varied by population. But I think it's also, he found this in the UK sample also, it's really hard to distinguish between those two levels for individuals. In terms of attribute importance, pain and mental health was very important, vitality was not important. The final decrements are often important. So in summary, the SF-12 version 1 and the SF-60 responses can be translated into qualities. Quality estimates vary by descriptive system due to differences in the definition of best and worst health. Now, look at these scales. One is the same, but the SF-12, the lowest possible quality value is 0.4. The SF-6D, the lowest possible value is 0.27. It's a very simple way of explaining this. Just like all instruments, the SF-12 does a much better job understanding the top end of health, not as much a good a job understanding the bottom end of health. The reason why the SF-60 does a little better on the bottom end of health is because the SF-60 includes problems with bathing and dressing. The worst thing you could have in terms of physical functioning for the SF-12, as you can see in the packets, is a lot of problems with moderate activities. They didn't include that item. So therefore, its worst possible response in terms of physical functioning, it has had a lower bound to it that was higher than the SF-6D. All right, it wasn't able to go down as low as the SF-6D. Qualys have become the gold measure standard in comparative effectiveness research according to the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force and the U.K. NICE. It doesn't mean it'll be there for that much longer, but I think that it is useful in summarizing measures. So there are lots of limitations to this study, and after these limitations, I can go through a couple examples. The first one is, this is a national internet survey. I have not done the reweighting yet. This is just a simple pilot internet survey. It's non-probability sampled. It has a lot of participation bias associated with it, and these results are unweighted. And so those are the things I'm hoping to address in future rounds. Second limitation is, insignificant decrements may suggest that the sample sizes are just too small. Maybe there is a value to that decrement. It's just we couldn't find it because our sample size wasn't large enough. The sum of the parts may not equal the whole. All of your problems in your life, when added together, may not be equal to the multiplicative relationship between your problems. And I'd love to get into these multiplicative relationships between the interactions between physical functioning and pain or depression, but I need more money to do so. I need to collect another sample, okay? So just something I'm working on. Last thing, that we have some problems with statistical inference. I'm using bootstrap approach. I'm not gonna get to that. And there's also a potential for order effects, like in any survey design. There's a question about how you ordered the items to see whether or not they influence the results. So here's a bunch of weights. How can you use this? How many here may have some SF-36 data that they have that they say, I have some data on these things. Maybe I want to take a look at them and see what it actually means. It might be useful to put it together. Well, here's a simple way you can do it. This is from the MEPS 2001 through 2003 that used the SF-12 version 1. So there are four lines up here. Men are at the top here. Women are down here. This is their qualities, okay? So as you can see here, that men actually have higher qualities than women, except non-white men, they seem to break apart in their 50s, having a lower quality of life than white men. In fact, you can see a similar thing between white and non-white women as time goes on, that there's a separation that occurs as they age, okay? To a point that actually after in your 60s, white women actually have a higher quality of life than black men. Okay? So that's interesting. You can look at different patterns that you can find in your data sets in terms of their overall quality of life. Second, this is from the Medical Health Outcomes Survey. This is a bunch of HMOs, individuals in HMOs that were surveyed in our Medicare HMOs. And this is a sample of 222,000 Medicare HMO beneficiaries. that completed two rounds of SF-36 responses. Now, this is a really complex but interesting graph. This, how many of you dealt with raw SF-36 scores, mental health and physical health? Okay, so this is the raw mental health score. This is the raw physical health score. And the gradation here reflects qualities. So these people here are in optimal health. They have a quality of 1. All right? So what this suggests is that if your physical health score is high, 1 or higher, your quality is pretty good. Your quality is 1. But as you move down this way, your quality level decreases. This is by 0.9, 0.8, 0.7, 0.6, 0.5, 0.4, 0.3, etc. as you move left. So in other words, as physical health declines, your quality declines. However, what's interesting is that as your mental health declines, it doesn't. Okay, the mental health score actually does not have any impact on qualities until it falls below a -2. Okay? As you go down this way, only then does it actually have an impact on qualities. All right? So that kind of gives you a different way of thinking about your component score data, that the physical health components actually matter a great deal more. Another problem with the physical health component, though, is it does a great job in differentiating the top of the scale, 1, 0.9, 0.8, 0.7, but does a really poor job of differentiating individuals at the lower end of the scale. Okay, those things are pretty slim between them. So a 1-unit change down here makes a big difference in terms of qualities. But a 1-unit change down here makes a very small difference in terms of qualities. Okay?
Why do those curves, some of them, bend?
Well,
at the right,
the bend represents the mental health.
No, I understand that, but they're bending, it's a U-shape.
Yeah, well, that's because I just did the quadratic here, and that's what forces it to bend.
Okay.
Only
so
slightly.
It's not that you get better mental health.
No, it would probably even itself out at the top. So if you have, you know, the people with good mental health, physical health matters. The people with poor mental, you have to have poor mental health below here to really have that start playing a part into their qualities, according to these estimates. So psychometrics are qualities. This is what the relationship, so physical health largely determines the qualities according to our estimates. Mental health has little effect until it gets below -1 or -2, really. Mental health attenuates the values of physical health, you can think of, only when it's really poor. Okay, it's only when mental health really gets the last ends of the scale. And these are according to this sample. So, future work. So, you know, with these values, you can put them onto your data set and look at the relationship with demographics and with component scores and so forth to understand what the importance is of these outcomes. But why are we just doing it with these descriptive systems? Well, this was a start. Okay, we could also take it to the EQ5D, and as I'm sure you all know, PROMIS is investing in a bunch of new ways of collecting data, patient report outcomes data. One of the things I'm very interested in doing it is taking to the patient reported outcomes of adverse events. So then we can actually look at the two sides of a trial and say, gosh, these adverse events are much more important than those adverse events. And say, gosh, you know, this is a much better profile according to societal values than that profile over there. And that may actually help us with some comparative effectiveness research. But we also need to recognize that patients other culturally diverse populations exist, and we might want to look closer at those populations to identify how they may be different. Also, we also need to understand that these methods have their own limitations. I mean, I can sit here and rank on the Stern Gamble, the TTO, and other techniques done for in the past for evaluations, but these approaches also have their issues. So to finish off, and this is the grandnephew's response to his uncle Ben Franklin, okay? And he says, "Dear and honored sir, thank you for your advice as to the algebraic calculation and will follow it. But in the matrimonial way, I a little differ from your opinion, and instead of mine never being married if I don't use it, I'm afraid I never shall be married if I do. For the negative column seems in this instance to be the weightiest. Before a man is married, he must fall in love. And this seems as involuntary an act as falling into a well. Your beautiful and affectionate kinsman, Jonah Williams. And well, a couple years later, Jonah married Miriam Alexander, and Dr. Franklin, then minister from the United States, was present at the ceremony in Paris, France. So I'd like to thank my collaborators on this project, my lab staff who helped me put this together, as well as my K-25 mentors, and my collaborators specifically, John Brasher, Simon Picard, Ellie Stoke, and Aki Tsuskaya. So, questions? Yes?
So could you comment on, from a cost-effective analysis, the difference between a patient preference versus a societal perspective? You know, I run a scleroderma program here, which is an orphan rheumatic disease, and when we did time trade-offs and standard gamble, we have done so far in over 400 patients where we have done individual. And you ask patients and they said, well, we have adjusted to our disease. And their scores are 0.9, 0.92. When we asked general population, we recruited about 200 general population and we developed the scenarios. And they gave the time trade-off for standard gamble scores of 0.2 or 0.3. So the difference between these two and from a cost-effectiveness analysis, the argument of using societal perspective, can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, like in any market, the people actually making the decisions, it's their perspectives that matter. Okay, because you're trying, in a decision analysis, you're trying to aid the decision maker. So whatever the decision maker's preferences are, those are the ones that you should be incorporating into the decision analysis. So the question is that if you're in the UK and your government is deciding on the allocation of resources, your government should represent the entirety of the people. Now, in the United States, we may believe in more patient autonomy, that we actually endow patients with the decision on deciding what's best for them and deciding the allocation of societal resources. But we haven't quite figured that one out yet. So we found more of this middle ground, which is insurers are making decisions about what goes on formulary and what doesn't go on formulary, or what treatments people have access to. And then the question is, which preferences do you want your insurance companies to use for coverage? And so, do we want societal or do we want patient? And I think it's a lively debate. From my point of view, though, I'd be interested in surveying both and understanding how they differ. Okay, giving some autonomy, but also understanding that society has these values that should also be considered. Maybe weighting those two sets of preferences.
Did you ask these people, not patients, that if they really understood the questions that you were asking? So one of the things we asked when we did the standard gamble with people, not patients, but people who were picked out of, you know, on the streets, and said, you know, and they're looking at you and they say, why are you asking us to gamble death or risk death or gamble our life for a magical treatment, and the understanding of those questions?
Oh yes, well, I've done quite a bit of research using the standard gamble in TTO, and which is why I've given up on it entirely, for that matter. It's because people do not understand them, especially when you put death on the line with each question. It's much easier for individuals to understand, oh well, over here I'll have a little bit more depression, over there I'll have a little bit more pain, and trying to understand the relative value of those things. But even with that simple question, you still have issues with experience and variety or differences of opinion within the population. The pair comparison is about as simple as you're ever going to get. It's going to be hard to get even simpler than that. And we, by doing this via the internet, we can do these things rather quickly and efficiently so that we can collect these data in without much difficulty. Versus TTO and Sarah Gamble, which have their nuances. They have boundary effects, they have starting point effects, they have, we know their problems. This one is actually probably longer lived. Yes?
Since you're talking more about the paired comparison, can you give you referred to multiplicative type relationships that you couldn't look at here, but maybe you could with more money, and you know, the HUI is one place where there is a multiplicative function, and David Pinio is the argument that these other systems are ad hoc corrections that they put in and estimate. the preference score because they assume independence.
Yeah, they assume additivity.
But I mean, can you talk about here? Couldn't tell. You can't look at it because of the data, the way you collected it, but you can in the future, or what did you mean?
I can, even with the data that I have collected. But I haven't yet, because we haven't gotten over these rudimentary questions of Partworth utility, of just understanding the additive decrements, let alone the interaction. In other words, when pain is compared to mental health, you may get a different response about the importance of pain than when pain is being compared to physical functioning. And so I can, with more data and probably a better data set, tease those things apart. But right now, we're not quite there yet. And it's a much more complex model, so therefore you would expect a larger sample size.
But have you even looked at whether they're transitive?
Whether additivity holds?
Yeah, it doesn't. Someone says pain is more than mental health and mental health is more than vitality. Does that necessarily imply? It's a transitivity property, which is implied in the...
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And that's one of the big limitations for what we're dealing with right now. But we haven't gotten past, under the assumption of transitivity, what do we have? Let alone relaxing transitivity, which makes it even noisier. Okay? So let's start with,
I'm sorry, but you have the data to simply study transitivity. They responded to all the pairs, right?
Yeah, well, they didn't do all the pairs. Can you imagine?
Oh.
The pair space is huge. They only get a sampling of the pairs. But you are right that there probably are multiplicative relationships. But that nuanced approach, the science isn't quite there yet. We're just trying to get people to understand that some items are more important than other items. Some level changes are more important than other level changes. Yes?
Do you have a demographic information for the respondents?
Yes.
They are male and young people?
Lots of older women. Not unusual for this field right now. Yes. That is a big limitation for Aranet surveys, and I'd love to have the funds to improve upon that. But once again, these are, in some sense, a pilot project.
A highly educated project, too.
Highly educated, few Hispanics, very few young people. More questions? Thank you so much.